Back in my day, Halloween was more about the candy than the costumes for most kids, and for good reason. Sometimes our moms would make us homemade costumes, like a hobo, and they'd use charcoal or shoe polish to put dirt streaks on our faces. And sometimes we could dress up as our favorite TV character like Superman, Frankenstein, G.I. Joe, or Barbie. Our parents could buy a $5 store-bought flammable apron with a thin plastic mask that fit pretty awkwardly, had two eye holes, and was held in place by a rubber band that pulled the far out of your hair. It was pretty magical. I can still smell the plastic. We used real knives to carve our own pumpkins, and if you were older than 3 years old, you weren't accompanied by parents. We went out at dark, sometimes on foot or on our bicycles, with our siblings, best friends, and a dream of filling a pillowcase with candy. People were more frugal back then, but most every neighbor in every neighborhood collectively participated, giving out popcorn balls, homemade peanut butter brittle, gospel tracts, and great big handfuls of the good candy. At some point, somebody's dad, who had one too many sips of the witch's brew, would jump out of a bush and scare everybody. We'd walk for hours through every neighborhood. On our way home, we'd dare each other to run through the graveyard. We never got home before 10, and nobody was worried or out looking for us. When we came in, our parents would swear that they needed to check our candy for razor blades and poison. And there must have been an awful lot of suspicious-looking chocolate, because there was always plenty missing when it got returned. At the end of the night, we would have a full pillowcase full of sweets. I'd go into my room, sort it into categories, and eat until my stomach hurt. Then we'd watch a scary movie or The Great Pumpkin, depending on which parent was still awake. Halloweens in my generation were better in every way.
I'm Darlene.
I'm Melody.
This is Hard Times and True Crimes.
This morning, I stopped by the coffee truck here locally in Asheboro at Taste and See Coffee Company. You've probably heard of them, I'm sure.
Yes, of course.
They're sponsoring this episode. Go ahead and tell us what you're having.
Pumpkin bread latte, and it is delish.
It smelled really good. I didn't taste it, although I wanted to. I'm having the butter pecan white chocolate. It feels pretty decadent, fall and cozy. It's very good. I appreciate their truck sponsoring us for this episode. Yes. I want to give a shout out to Megan and Taylor. They're sisters that run the truck. They were gracious to do that. And I love the name of their coffee truck, Taste and See. It's based on a verse from Psalms 34:8. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusteth in him.
Oh, I love that.
And so it's nice when you're sitting in line at their little drive-thru to get your coffee and your Bible.
And they're super sweet.
So sweet.
Pretty redheaded girls.
Yeah. And so they're usually parked at Aldi, but sometimes they are other places. So y'all go by, get you some coffee from them, tell them we sent you. If you want to know where they're going to be and when, you can follow them on their socials. Instagram, it is Taste and See Coffee Co.
Okay. And that's Aldi's here in Asheboro.
Locally here in Asheboro, North Carolina.
All right. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell them what we got to do Monday?
Yes. So Darlene and I went
to High Point.
Yes.
Lakeside Integrative.
And we got some work done on our faces.
Yes. It was awesome.
It was. So we had microneedling and resurfacing. We both got the service done.
Yes. We both have a wedding coming up.
Yes. Not our own.
No. But we both wanted to look nice for it and get rid of some of those wrinkles.
And for me, age spots, because, you know, I'm a child of the 70s and I grew up worshiping the sun, 70s and 80s, you know. And so I wanted to get rid of some of those darker age spots.
Yeah, I was really nervous about the microneedling, but And it was worth it. Beauty is pain, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't bad.
It wasn't bad.
Right.
But definitely so worth it. We can already both see some results and some differences. Yeah.
I can tell a big difference in the wrinkles in my jawline. And that's probably where I noticed the most difference. And around my lips, like I just feel like it like lifted everything already.
Yes. And you can see it. It's visible result. Yeah. Like you said. And like over the lines over my lips, I also noticed that as well.
Mm-hmm. Thankfully, we took before and after pictures, so you can see a remarkable difference.
Yeah, and we'll try to post those for you, although I don't really like posting those befores, but that's okay.
We don't have any makeup on, but you know, you can excuse us.
Yes. So we want to give them a shout out. We actually are going to continue. We both have two more treatments left with them.
Because I'm in menopause, I also got laser hair removal above my lip and my chin, you know, just a little bit of that sprouting.
Yeah.
I'm so excited about that.
And when will you know, like...
There was immediately a difference. I'll have more treatments. It'll get even...
More noticeable.
More noticeable. But I already notice a huge difference. So it's exciting.
It is exciting. So we're going to be ready for those weddings come fall.
Anyway, guys, if you are interested in anything like that, make sure you go to High Point to Lakeside Integrative and Tasha Bryles and Mandy. They're the ones that do the work and they're awesome. And Sweet Chelsea is at the front and she will make your appointments for you. And just tell them that Darlene and Melody from Hard Times and True Crime sent you.
Yes, absolutely. And we will keep you posted as we continue our other treatments as to what our progress is.
Yes, we're going to definitely be posting pictures. Just don't judge us because we won't have any makeup on in these pictures.
They'll be in our Facebook group.
Okay, Melody. So do you have any fun Halloween memories from your childhood?
I do have a few. Yes.
Well, let's hear some.
My oldest sister, you know, she's a little bit morbid. I've told you that before.
Yeah.
I do remember her when we were really little taking us through the graveyard on Halloween.
Okay.
One year we dressed up like Kiss.
That's fun.
Yeah. And so she was Gene Simmons and I was Paul Stanley and my sister Kim was Peter Criss. And I forget who was Ace Frehley, but that was a pretty fun memory for me.
I love that. When I was really little, I actually wasn't allowed to trick-or-treat. My mom was newly saved, and she did not allow it. I only have one childhood memory of, I don't know what happened, but my mom decided to take me this one year, and it was just me and her. It would have been, let's see, it would have been 1983, so I was really young, about five. That I remember, she only took me to two houses. We went to a lady's from church. I want to say her name was Viola. And then we went to my grandma Thomas's. But we must have went to some other houses because I had a little stash of candy. When we went back home, my mother made me lay all my candy out on the table. And she smashed it with a hammer looking for razor blades.
Yes, I remember those 80s days.
I remember thinking, is this really necessary? I was so mad. And I remember like licking my finger and then getting the little tiny pieces, the shards of this green sucker off the table and like licking them off my finger.
Oh, goodness.
She loosened up a little bit when we moved to Nashville.
Yeah.
And so my brother and sister were, of course, allowed to have all the fun and they went trick or treating.
Right.
And so I would take them. I would have been about 13 then. And let me tell you, Nashville did not disappoint.
Oh, I can only imagine that that was probably a very big event.
It was. We got full-size candy bars. I mean, it was amazing. So I actually would take them, quote unquote, for the next couple of years. It was a lot of fun. So for me, I always let my kids trick-or-treat because I felt like I missed out.
Yeah. Well, see, we did trick-or-treat all growing up. And then when I had my older girls, we did not do Halloween. We did Reformation night, November the 1st. And so we did a big thing with candy and stuff. We used to have events at our house.
Oh.
We had a Reformation trail.
That is so cool.
Yeah, they would walk through the woods at night and come up on these reformers and they would tell them their stories.
Tell me like a couple of the reformers.
Martin Luther.
Yes.
The big one.
Of course.
And then John Knox, Calvin.
That's John awesome. Calvin.
And, oh, there were so many. And then we did Bloody Mary one time.
Ooh, I'm going to be talking about her soon.
Yeah, and she wasn't really a reformer, but when you do that story, you'll see how that plays into the time period. But now that I've got three more children, we've loosened up a little bit too, and so my kids go trunk-or-treating now.
Yeah. Well, now there's all these fun things like trunk-or-treats. Mm-hmm. The hell houses.
Oh, yeah. There's, yes.
Do you know what I'm talking mm-hmm. about?
Yeah, my husband worked in one of those for years.
My husband did too. And we did one at a church here. It was actually a lot of fun.
So you don't have to worry about getting razor blades in your candy.
Exactly. This story may have something to do with my mom smashing all my candy whenever I was 5 years old. In 1974, 30-year-old Ronald Clark O'Brien lived with his wife and their two children, Timothy and Elizabeth, in a Houston suburb called Deer Park. After years of barely getting by, Ronald had been blessed with this really good job as an optician at Texas State Optical. It wasn't a job where he was going to get rich off of his pay, but it did pay the bills. And for the first time in a long time, his family's future was looking promising. The family were devoted members of the Second Baptist Church in Pasadena.
That's interesting. Usually the First Baptist Church.
Ronald sang in the choir, and he even served as a deacon and oversaw a bus ministry there. He was really involved. On October 31st, 1974, it was an exciting night at the O'Briens. Ronald and Danine, they had never really done much with the kids on Halloween, mostly because of their financial issues. Buying costumes, it seemed frivolous mm-hmm. when they didn't have a lot of money. But for the first time in years, or maybe even ever, Ronald was excited about this Halloween. This year, he could afford to buy his 8-year-old son, Timothy, and 5-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, costumes. And he promised to take them trick-or-treating in the rich part of Pasadena.
Mm-hmm. It's always, everybody looks for the rich red neighborhood.
Exactly.
For trick-or-treating.
And that's where they gave out the good stuff.
Right.
You know, like the full-size candy bars.
Exactly. And not the popcorn balls.
Ronald had invited some friends to go with them, the Bates family, and they actually lived out in that neighborhood over in Pasadena. They had kids, their kids' age, and their wives were friends, and Ronald was friends with Jim Bates. And so the Bates invited the O'Briens over to their house that night. They were making a roast pork dinner, and then after supper, they were all going to go out trick-or-treating. But Halloween Day in 1974 had been colder than usual. So later in the afternoon, it had started to drizzle and then rain. 8-year-old Timothy, he was getting worried that his parents would change their minds about trick-or-treating. But Ronald assured him that no matter what, he promised he was taking them. Timothy was super excited because his dad had surprised him with a Planet of the Apes costume.
Fun.
So they all got dressed up and they went over to the Bates family's house where they were eating their roast. And the kids, like you were that day with the chicken and dumplings, they were way too excited to eat. You know, those kids were ready to get some candy. I've been there. The moms got to talking about how cold it was and how wet it was. And they probably weren't really looking forward to going out in it. But, you know, moms, we do what we got to do.
Yeah.
Then Jim, he asked Ronald, maybe we should just go buy the kids some candy this year. But Ronald was like, no, I've made a promise to the kids and I, you know, he really wanted to keep it. If I had been one of those kids, I would have appreciated that.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ladies, I don't know about you, but over the last few years, Melly and I have noticed differences in our skin that have been pretty discouraging. You know, the inevitable signs of aging, fine lines, some wrinkles here and there, dull, dry skin, and sunspots. Thankfully, there's a non-invasive treatment available without having to go under the knife. Tasha Bryles at Lakeside Integrative in High Point, North Carolina, offers a total skin package that includes radiofrequency microneedling and laser skin resurfacing that can be done right in her office in under an hour. It stimulates collagen growth and elastin that improves the surface and texture of your skin, as well as tightening it. The laser treats acne scars, minimizes large pores, and lessens, if not completely fades, sunspots. Melody and I were blessed to get this treatment in late fall. We're going back for our after photos within a couple of weeks, and we'll be sure to post them on our Facebook group. Melody was just saying how she felt like it gave her a fresh start for her skin routine. It even cleared up some precancerous skin lesions she had, and it faded my sunspots completely as well as brightened and tightened my skin. We're really thrilled with our results. Lakeside Integrative offers an array of other services for men and women, as well as fillers, laser hair removal, weight loss, hormone, and medical treatments. Don't walk. Run to the phone and call Lakeside Integrative to set up your appointment at 336-715-0007. Tell them Darlene and Melody from Hard Times and True Crime sent you.
Yeah, I would have felt like I got really cheated if you just went and bought me some candy. Because the experience is part of it.
Exactly. And they wanted to show off their costumes.
Yeah.
And Jim agreed that as excited as the kids were, it would have been a shame not to take them. But they told their wives they didn't really see the need in them going out in the weather, that they could handle the kids and they could stay home. And one of the younger Bates children ended up staying home with them, the two men and three kids. One of Jim Bates' kids and then Ronald O'Brien's two children went out in this Pasadena neighborhood. So the kids are having a blast. Even with the rain, they're running around, having a good time. It is really getting rainy, though.
Okay.
So, you know, it slows things down. It's not as fun, but the kids are still enjoying it. I think Jim was probably wanting to wrap things up.
Right. Yeah, I can see that.
But anyway, after they went to a few houses, I think they had gone down one street and then the second street, they came up on this house and it was dark. It was 4112 Donnerail Street. There were no lights on, but O'Brien and the kids, they went on up to the door anyway. And after knocking, they didn't get an answer. And so the kids and Jim, they moved on ahead. But O'Brien, he stayed behind. And then a few minutes later, he caught up with the rest of them. And he had a big smile on his face because he'd hit the jackpot. He had these 5 22-inch pixie sticks.
Oh, wow.
You remember the big ones?
I do. And that's nothing but pure sugar.
Pure sugar. But the kids were like jumping up and down like, yes.
After those, they were probably jumping up and down for days.
He was their hero. They were, of course, thanking him for the candy. And he gave each of the kids one. But he's like, don't eat it now. Just please. Wait. And then he suggested like, okay, we have enough. Let's go home. And they were okay with it. They'd had a good run. So the crew headed back home, and Ronald gave his friend Bate one of the pixie sticks for his other kid that didn't end up going with them that night. And after the O'Briens got back home to Deer Park, the kids were excitedly telling their mom, oh my goodness, this is what we did. You know how kids are. They're excited. And then some trick-or-treaters showed up to the door. Mrs. O'Brien was like, I'm sorry, I don't have anything. But then Mr. O'Brien was like, I got one pixie stick because there were 5 or 6 kids.
Yeah.
And he's like, who wants it? And they're like, me. So anyway, one lucky little boy, he gave it to him and that was all they had.
Gosh, you got to feel bad for the other four.
I know. Poor kids. So Mrs. O'Brien, she ended up having to run out. It was a little bit late, but she had to run to the store. Ronald said, I'll put the kids to bed. They were tired anyway. So he didn't feel like that was going to be much of a chore. They were pooped. The kids changed out of their costumes and were getting ready to brush their teeth when he told them, you know what? You can have one more piece of candy. Timothy chose, what do you think he chose?
That pixie stick?
Yeah. Now, there were staples holding the top of it closed, but Ronald helped him get it open. And you know how sometimes that pixie dust will get clumped up?
Mm-hmm. If it gets any moisture in it, yeah.
Right. So it was clumped up and he couldn't get it out of the top. So Ronald took his fingers and broke it up. And then he told him, open up and poured it into his mouth. Well, as soon as he got the sugar into his mouth, he made this face like, oh, this is bitter. And Ronald was like, or I'll go to the kitchen and get you some Kool-Aid and wash it down. But by the time he got back, Timothy was throwing up.
Oh, no.
And he was crying. His stomach hurt. Within just a few minutes, he is profusely vomiting. He's got the foam coming out the sides of his mouth. He's convulsing. And Ronald quickly calls for help.
Mm-hmm.
But 90 minutes after eating his pixie stick at 10:30 p.m., Timothy O'Brien died on the way to the hospital.
Oh, I hate that. That's awful. How much of it did he get in him?
About 4 inches of the top of it was gone.
Well, that's quite a bit.
Yeah, it is. It's a good bit. His mother, she had gone to the store.
Right.
She fell apart, as you can imagine. I mean, she just could not understand how in the world this could have happened.
Hmm.
And his dad was visibly upset, too. And then from everything authorities had learned about the night's events, they came to a conclusion fairly quickly that Timothy had been poisoned.
Oh, gracious.
And that it had most likely come from that pixie stick.
Right. And I'm sure maybe that wasn't immediately what they thought. I mean, it was what I thought, but because, you know, right, I grew up in the 70s and 80s and we checked our candy, but...
Right. Well, I guess they knew since he had that reaction. As soon as
so
he
it was
had been
pretty
given.
Instantaneous.
Yeah. I mean, the dad told him. He's like, I gave him the candy and...
Okay. So there was really no question.
Right.
Ever. Okay.
And then the very next day, it was confirmed that it was cyanide poisoning.
Gracious.
Timothy had enough of the poison in his system to kill 2 grown men.
Oh, my word.
So after talking to O'Brien that night, they learned that there were at least 4 more of these pixie sticks floating around, and probably more. And I mean, this is just in this little group.
Right. I wonder where those other 2 kids, had they not eaten theirs yet?
Elizabeth Ronald's younger daughter had 1 of the sticks.
Okay.
And so thankfully she had not touched hers. At 11 p.m., the cops, you know, they're banging on the Bates door. They're frantic because 2 of the potentially poisoned pieces of candy had been given to their children.
Right.
Thankfully, Mrs. Bates had not allowed her children to eat any more candy that night.
Mm.
By the grace of God.
Mm-hmm.
But they still had to track down the trick-or-treater. Remember, the trick-or-treater came to the door and...
Oh, and they had given them
And Ronald
one.
Had given him
Oh, that's
one.
Right. Oh, my.
But within a few hours, they figured out who the little boy was and they went banging on his door. They found the little boy laying in his bed fast asleep with that giant pixie stick in his hand, and he had been trying to get the staples out of the top and could not.
Oh, thank God he didn't.
I know.
Like, I just felt relief when you said that.
And he had literally tried everything he could, but he was not strong enough, thankfully.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine the relief of that mother? Well, authorities knew that all 5 of those pixie sticks had been tampered with because they were all stapled shut instead of being heat sealed.
Mm-hmm.
And the manufacturers heat sealed them closed.
I was going to ask you earlier, is that when you said they were stapled at the top, I was going to say, is that what they did?
I mean,
back
I was
then?
Trying to remember. And
I was trying
like,
to remember, yeah.
I couldn't like, really
they have
remember.
Staples in them? Yeah.
But no, they were definitely heat
tampered.
Sealed.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They would also learn that the tops of each of those pixie sticks had been filled 2 inches with cyanide.
Wow.
2 inches of cyanide, and then the rest was candy. Now, in the case of Timothy, 4 inches was missing from the top of the pixie stick,
mm-hmm.
and there was actually no cyanide in the remainder of it.
Okay.
So he had probably eaten about 2 inches of the cyanide and then 2 inches of the candy.
Right.
The Pasadena area was frantic.
I'm sure.
As you can imagine, when they learned about kids' Halloween candy.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to assume poisoned. The cops were at that house pretty quickly where they had gotten it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm going to tell you what, these cops were on it.
Good.
They were incredible. Yeah. Like I said, the next day they had those results back. I mean, mm-hmm. they were really working fast. The police department asked parents, they went on TV and they were like, you need to be vigilant and check in your children's candy and bring in anything that looks suspicious. And they ended up with an entire room full of candy that parents had dropped off.
Oh, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, I probably wouldn't have let my kids eat anything
Mm-mm.
that year.
That would have all been, I would have yeah. taken it right over to the police department.
Absolutely.
And bought my kids candy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, that had always kind of been a fear, I think, because of Halloween movies and just urban legends, stories.
Mm-hmm.
But until Timothy's death, poison trick-or-treat candy was, that's really all it was an urban legend, because there had never even been 1 documented case of anything like that ever happening in the United States.
And Honestly, like, I still thought it was an urban legend, because when you were talking about growing up in the 70s and 80s, you heard those stories.
Yes.
About the poison and the razor blades.
Yes.
And then years later, I heard those were all urban legends. I did not know that there was a real documented case of that happening.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I am surprised by
1974.
This.
Well, Ronald O'Brien, he was a big man. This is Timothy's dad. He had a soft-spoken, almost feminine voice. He sang a song at his son Timothy's funeral service, and there was hardly a dry eye, of course, in the room. You know, like the lady said in the Dingo Ate My Baby episode, that he did have a peace in knowing that his son was in heaven now.
Oh, which really just gets you.
It does. Meanwhile, detectives were working night and day trying to figure out who poisoned this candy, because very likely there's a lot more out there.
Yeah.
Detective Bill Lanier, this was his first murder investigation, and he interviewed O'Brien several times because he was the one that gave him the candy.
Sure.
I mean, he was the last one with him.
He has to do his job and check out every possibility.
Exactly. Ronald was having a hard time remembering facts about the night, like where the pixie sticks had come from at first. And honestly, that is normal. Losing a child is traumatic and things get hazy. I do not remember details.
Yeah.
I would probably look really bad because I just don't remember details.
I'm sort of like that too. I'm just kind of not really observant.
He told the detectives that he knew that he'd been given the giant pixie sticks from a home in the same subdivision they trick-or-treated in. But first he said he didn't know which home, and then he couldn't remember the street. But detectives soon realized that they had only taken the kids trick-or-treating on two streets because of their weather.
Okay, so that narrows it down.
Yes. And then O'Brien told detectives that he didn't actually see a person, just an arm sticking out of the door. Well, because, like I said, the lights were off that night.
Mm-hmm. I know you can see the look on my face. I'm like, I'm perplexed here, but okay.
Yeah. The detectives took O'Brien back to the Pasadena neighborhood and walked him up and down the streets where they had gone trick-or-treating with his children. And after really doubling down, like, look, this is important. Mm-hmm. We have got to figure this out. He finally did point to the house where he got the pixie sticks. And the house belonged to Courtney Melvin, who was an air traffic controller at Hobby Airport. O'Brien then identified Melvin as the man who'd handed him the candy, which I thought was weird because he said that he hadn't seen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think things are just kind of changing.
Now, I do have some questions in my brain. You want me to hold them? Because you're probably going to cover them.
Yeah, hold them.
Okay.
Then they went to Melvin's job and they arrested him real quick. But Melvin had an airtight alibi. I feel really bad for him, actually, that he got arrested in front of all of his colleagues, everybody at the airport.
Mm.
Because it was established that he had not even gotten home from work until 11 p.m. on Halloween night.
Okay.
Guys, you might hear weed eating and lawn mowing and dogs. Everything just seems to be happening at once. But anyway.
And they are sure that he had nothing to do with it.
Yes. He actually had over 200 people who vouched for his whereabouts and saw him at work.
That's pretty airtight.
It really is.
So now, yeah, I feel bad for him too.
And his wife, Carolyn Melvin, she had been home that night and she passed out candy to trick-or-treaters until 6:45 when she ran out of candy. And then, you know, like we all do, she shut off the lights and didn't answer the door anymore.
That was one of my questions. I'm like, yeah, the guy went and got the pixie sticks, but the lights were already off. So why did the people have pixie sticks?
Right.
And my other question was, what's up with the creepy arm handing the stuff out the door?
Right. Well, we'll get into that.
Because everybody knows you don't go to the houses
with the lights off.
With the lights off.
Right. And also the candy that she had handed out, it was not giant pixie sticks. And in fact, detectives walked the route that O'Brien and Bates had taken with their kids that night.
Mm-hmm.
And they could not find any other children outside of this one group who had been given giant pixie sticks. And there were no houses on that whole route who had given out pixie sticks.
Oh my gosh, that's creepy.
Mm-hmm. Detectives, they were getting weirded out. They were suspicious. And they were starting to think, like, Ronald O'Brien.
Well, I'm
they were getting suspicious of him.
Well, was he the one that went to the door? Was the Bates guy?
It was Ronald O'Brien. It
that
was
went
the
to
dad.
The door.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they were thinking, why would he want to hurt his own son? They just couldn't think of a motive.
Okay.
It was just hard to make sense of. And he seemed genuinely upset.
Yeah.
But then they got this call the day after Timothy's death that Ronald had called an insurance company about collecting on a life insurance policy that he had taken out on Timothy just 30 days before his death.
Oh my goodness, are you serious?
Mm-hmm. In fact, he had taken out life insurance policies on both of his children in the month leading up to Halloween.
Mm.
Those policies came out to be $60,000, which today would be between $300,000 and $400,000.
I'm not liking this.
Mm-mm. So, of course, they called in Danine, his wife, and asked her, hey, let me ask you about these insurance policies that you have. And she was like, well, we only have one policy for $10,000, and we're all insured for $10,000 because we were able to get it for just a few bucks a month. It's really cheap. She said her husband had taken out a more expensive policy on the kids before, but she had insisted that he cancel it immediately because, and she was mad that he had even taken out the policy because they were broke. Mm. Like they could really afford monthly insurance payments on policies for their kids who were so young and right. so unlikely to die anyway. It was just such a waste of money that they needed. When detectives told her about these other policies, she was genuinely stunned.
Oh my gracious.
Now, Mrs. O'Brien was totally honest with the detectives and she was very cooperative. She told them that Ronald had gotten them into over $100,000 in debt.
Oh, wow.
Which today would be over $600,000. Oh, O'Brien had been through 21 jobs in 10 years.
He's starting to look a lot more guilty.
The family had been thankful for this new job he had gotten as an optician. Well, Danine and the kids were thankful anyway. Even though it only paid $150 a week, they recently sold their home and they moved into that condo over there in Deer Creek. With the money from the sale of their house, they were able to pay off some of their debt, about $50,000. Even though they still owed a lot of money, I mean, they were still very heavily in debt. With him having this steady employment, she was good with money, and she had been able to start making some small payments toward some of this outstanding debt. Little did she know her husband was over 8 months behind on his car payment.
Oh, my word. I was going to say, what in the world is he getting them in debt with? Like, what is he buying?
I think he was just one of those people that was obsessed with stuff.
And can't manage his money and buy right. stuff whether he can afford it or not.
Right, right. And apparently, crazy stuff, $100,000?
Yeah. He didn't know about Dave Ramsey.
No, he did not. His car was actually getting ready to be repossessed, but she was totally unaware of this.
I can't believe it was 8 months behind and had not already been repossessed.
It's crazy. And also, he was getting ready to be fired from his job at Texas State Optical because they believed that he was stealing on the job.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, things are not looking good for him.
And then on October 23rd, just 8 days before his son's murder, O'Brien had called and got an extension on one of his payments, and I believe that was his car payment. He said that he was expecting to come into some money before the end of the year.
Get out.
And that he would be able to pay off what he owed.
Oh, my goodness.
He told one of his coworkers that he was going to be quitting his job in November and that his financial situation was about to turn around.
Mm.
Knowing that he was planning to quit might be the only reason they hadn't already fired him.
Yeah.
Authorities had they had definitely established a motive.
Mm-hmm.
But then was there any connection to Ronald and the poison? You know, because all of this stuff, it is circumstantial, but it's heavy circumstance. I mean, it's a lot.
It is.
But now the poison.
Yeah.
Well, I'm
sorry. I just got all these questions in my
go
mind.
Ahead. Ask them.
I'm putting a lot of stuff together because earlier I was also thinking, you know, it's just like a dad to pour 4 inches of sugar down your son's throat, but that mama right. would have never let that happen before bedtime kind
exactly.
of thing. But now that I see that in a different light.
It makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. After some digging, they found out that In August of 1974, just a couple of months before October, O'Brien put in an order at work for cyanide. When he was questioned about it, he said that he was going to use it for cleaning gold frames. And this was really strange because cyanide hadn't been used to clean glasses in the optical field for 20 years.
Okay. I didn't know that it had ever been used.
Yeah. I mean, apparently back in the 50s and prior to that. So in September of 1974, O'Brien called a friend of his named Bobby Terry and told him, "Hey, I'm taking this chemical course at a local college and I just want to pick your brain." He asked him all sorts of questions like, where could cyanide be purchased? What would be considered a fatal dose of cyanide? He wanted to know what the procedures were to detect poison in a dead body.
Okay, well, that's a heck of a lot of circumstantial evidence.
Mm-hmm. He just could not keep his fat mouth shut.
Nope.
He talked about cyanide at work, casually talking about what a fatal dose would be. Just before Halloween, he had gone to a chemical outlet in Houston called Curtin Matheson Scientific. And he talked to the salesperson there named David Lee Jackson. He just wanted to buy a small amount of cyanide. But Jackson was like, look, five pounds is really the smallest we sell here because it was you get it in bulk. And he was so aggravated that he couldn't get this small amount. But he inquired like, okay, well, where can I get a small amount? Then a customer of O'Brien's would testify later that on Halloween, he saw O'Brien in the parking lot carrying a stapler and a bag of unknown contents. Then during their appointment, this customer remembered that a part of their conversation was about cyanide and what a lethal amount would be.
He was an idiot.
He was an idiot.
I love it, though, when these idiots
hang themselves.
Hang themselves.
Jim Bates, the man he went trick-or-treating with,
mm-hmm.
He revealed that Ronald wore his lab coat all night long when they went trick-or-treating. At the time, he thought he was wearing it like a part of a costume kind of thing.
Okay.
But now, in light of everything, he was thinking, yeah, he's probably used it to hide those pixie sticks.
Oh, my gosh. And, like, he gave one. Like, he didn't just give it to his kids. He gave one to that guy's kid.
Both of his kids.
Yes. And the kid that came trick. Yes. Oh, my word.
Yeah. This guy was evil.
Pure and out evil.
So at this point, police believed O'Brien fully intended to kill both of his own children for life insurance money. And the other three kids, they were just collateral damage to cover up at the murders.
Right. It's like he even gave no thought. Mm-hmm. Like you said, it's collateral damage. Wow. Yeah.
The evidence, I mean, at this point, it's overwhelming. Yes. Ronald O'Brien was arrested then on November 5th in 1974, less than 1 week after Timothy's death.
Yeah, that didn't take long.
And he was charged with one count of capital murder and four counts of attempted murder.
Okay, so capital murder
will
get you the death penalty on the table, right?
It's on the table. So his trial began on May 5th in 1975. He pled not guilty on all five counts. Of course he did.
Of course. I'm sorry. They didn't see my eyes roll.
The prosecution, it was led by a man named Mike Hinton. I really like him. I didn't go into a lot of detail about him here, but this guy was a spitfire. Just to show you what a sicko O'Brien was, during the trial, he smiled at the prosecutor and offered him a Tootsie Roll.
Oh, my gracious. What an arrogant.
Yes.
I hope the end of this story is, I hope I get justice here. Not me. I hope at the end, everybody gets a sense of justice has been done.
Later on, they asked him years later, he gave this interview and he was like, you know, people say, I know you're tired of talking about him. He was like, I never get tired of talking about that sorry son of a...
Yeah, I bet he does.
Anyway, I won't go into that, but yeah, he was something. Danine O'Brien, she testified against her own husband. She said that she had no idea about those additional life insurance policies. She remembered before Timothy's death, her husband quoted this weird Bible story about how Abraham must have felt about sacrificing his only son.
Oh, my gracious. You're giving me chills.
Yeah. She just started putting these things together. She said she'd really wanted to believe him. I mean, he's her husband, but she knew deep down that he had murdered their son.
Mm.
Bates, which was the man that, you know, had gone trick-or-treating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He testified that he hadn't seen anyone answer the door at the Melvins that Halloween night, but that he had seen O'Brien holding those pixie sticks in his hand. He also testified that Ronald wore that lab coat.
Mm-hmm.
Remember I told you? And, you know, even when they were eating dinner, and now just in hindsight, how strange that was. Bates said that although Ronald looked grief-stricken in public, privately he was unemotional. He said that at his own son's funeral, when he was going up on stage to sing, which now makes me sick.
Oh, I know.
By the way,
that's right.
Ugh. He said that he watched him pass right by Timothy's open coffin, you know, to get on the stage. And he said he literally just walked right past him, didn't even glance at his son.
Mm.
And he just said in that moment, it was chilling. And from that moment on, he thought he did it.
My goodness.
Bates said that at one point, Ronald told him there was actually no way that cops were going to be able to pin Timothy's death on anybody.
Oh, my goodness. He sounds, there's this word again. He sounds like a narcissist.
Yeah, or a sociopath.
Sociopath? Mm-hmm. Is that more of the...
I think so, because I was trying to figure that out last night, and I was like, he just doesn't have any...
Feeling.
No feeling for anybody else. None.
None, yeah. And again... I mean, you know, we're not psychologists, but
right.
We do like to think of things in terms of like, what were these people thinking and what have they got going on mentally to make them do something like this and to not even have any remorse.
No, I mean, and like we know with sociopaths, they do have feelings, but it's all for themselves. Who would care more about their financial state than their child's life?
Right.
Or anybody's life.
Right. There has to be some kind of a disorder there. I don't want to give it a label or an excuse, but you know what I'm saying? There has to be something mentally wrong.
Right. A few weeks before the murder, Ronald also told Bates that his family was going to be buying a house soon, but told him not to mention this to Danine, his wife.
Oh, we're going to buy a house, but my wife doesn't know.
Right. He just could not shut his mouth. He couldn't help himself. He was so excited about killing his kid, and he was going to kill both of his kids.
Yes. And also, I feel like, I think there's like that arrogancy there
that keeps him
running his mouth.
Yeah.
Because he's so confident that he's getting away with this.
Yeah.
He thinks he has thought of the perfect way to do this.
He does. Like he said, there's no way cops are going to be able to. And I think because you know how everybody was at that time, the panic about candy and stuff like that. And he thought, that's it. He thought he was so smart.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to be able to
to
pull it off. Because everybody would just think, oh, it's this Halloween candy. Nobody will be able to trace it.
They'd be thinking it was some psycho. And it really was some psycho.
And I can just play the grieving father. So he really thought he had this thing all figured out. O'Brien's own brother and sister-in-law testified that at the funeral, Ronald had talked about using money from Timothy's life insurance policy to take a long vacation.
Oh, my gracious. Like, it just gets deeper and deeper here.
Mm-hmm. Other witnesses testified that he was a pathological liar, which I can definitely see that.
And what's that? Is that one of the sociopath symptoms, pathological liar?
Yep. Ronald O'Brien then testified on his own behalf, of course,
as sociopaths
often do, of course, declaring his innocence.
Mm-hmm.
His defense claimed Timothy had been the victim of the crazy people who laced little kids' candy with cyanide. Like I mentioned earlier, you know, there had been zero documented cases of this. Just a legend. Sometimes I think that churches, I don't know, they hang on to stuff like that and spread it around, preaching it from pulpits to like kind of scare believers into submission and away from evil. I think they mean it for good. But then parents, of course, we use these fake scenarios then to scare our children into submission. And what ends up happening is that everybody loses credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 100% guilty of some of this with my children. So, you know, but I do think that happened a lot back then. So I think it was a big thing where everybody was scared, mm-hmm. you know. Anyway, I digress. But the jury did not buy this mad poisoner story. And on June 2nd, 1975, after deliberating for 46 minutes, they came back with a guilty verdict.
I think that's the shortest jury deliberation I've ever heard.
I know. Guilty on one count of capital murder and four counts of attempted murder. Okay. So he was found guilty on all charges.
Okay, good. And they went in there and they said, do you think he did it? Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
They took that back out.
Then during the penalty phase, they took 71 minutes before they decided that O'Brien was going to be sentenced to death. Right after his conviction, Dainin filed for divorce. She believed that he was guilty and she was happy with the jury's verdict.
Yeah. Poor woman and their poor daughter because.
Oh, I know.
She now knows that her dad did this to her brother and was going to do it to her.
I know. I'm going to talk about that a little bit toward the end. But yeah, Dainin said that she realized that she was probably her husband's his original target because just before Halloween, he had made an appointment for her to sign up for some life insurance. Which she did, but then tried to pay things and realized, like, we don't have the money to pay this. And so she couldn't pay the premium and they canceled it.
That is
chilling.
Yes. And not unlike that other episode we did about Ted Kimball.
Right.
Taking out that policy without his wife's consent.
Mm-hmm.
Gracious. Man, I'm telling you, it makes you, like, I don't know, if your husband wants to take out some life insurance.
Oh, I know. So Ronald's attorneys successfully did get two stays of execution. So they were postponed May 25th, 1982, and then October 31st, 1982, which actually would have been the 8th anniversary of Timothy's death. But they scheduled a third date, and that this was March 31st of 1984. His attorneys fought for another stay of execution on the grounds that lethal injection was cruel and unusual. O'Brien was...
Well, so is dying of cyanide poisoning. Yeah,
so is suffering. Exactly. O'Brien was actually going to be the first prisoner put to death in Texas by lethal injection. The federal judge denied that appeal. They interviewed Dainin, his ex-wife, you know, how are you feeling about all this? And she said, I'm really glad it's coming to an end. She said, I do not think that Ronald is a sick or insane person. I think he is perverted.
Mm.
Dainin had remarried and tried her best to keep living, even with this terrible void from living 9 years without her son, Timothy. She said that her daughter, Elizabeth, had been her priority during this time. Her daughter was 15 now, and Dainin just wanted Elizabeth to be able to put all of this behind her. She had done well despite the circumstances, but recently she had actually wanted to contact and visit her father on death row, and Dainin refused to let her. She said no because, so after Ronald had been arrested, now this was before his trial, but after he had been arrested, she visited him every week.
Dainin did
every single week. And she said that every time she went, he cried and he swore to her, begging her to believe that he was innocent. And she said he was convincing, you know, manipulators are.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that even though she knew deep down he did it, he really made her question herself. Like, am I crazy? Like, is everybody wrong? Is he telling the truth? Because she said he was just so convincing and she did not want her daughter to go through that confusion.
Oh, I'm so glad that she recognized that and protected her daughter from that. Because, you know, especially it's one thing to be the wife, but to be the daughter and that be your father, it would be easy to be swayed by that.
It would.
I don't blame her one bit.
And you want to make sense of it.
Right. And you want to believe that they wouldn't do that.
You do. I mean, I see killers all the time. We know they're guilty. Like, there's all this evidence, but their children have a very hard time believing. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the lawyer, the South Carolina lawyer.
Murdaugh.
I'm thinking of his son.
Yeah.
And then the Lori Vallow. Mm-hmm. Well, not her, but her
family members.
I think now they believe it. But her husband, Chad, Mm-hmm. His children do not believe that he had anything to do with their mother's murder, and he did.
Right, right. And there are people in her family who still don't believe
that
she did.
Oh, really?
There are some cousins and stuff. I've seen some interviews that are still taken up for her.
That's insane.
It is insane.
And it's so, yeah. So anyway, her mother.
It would be hard to believe, yeah.
It would. And her mother, I think, was wise. She said that as difficult as it was to accept, Ronald intended to kill their daughter.
He did.
And Elizabeth did eventually come to terms with that.
Okay, good.
Ronald O'Brien's last meal was a well-done T-bone steak, French fries and ketchup, corn, sweet peas, lettuce and tomato salad with egg and French dressing, sweet tea, saltine crackers, rolls, and a Boston cream pie.
I wish they would have stuck a pixie stick in there with.
Me too.
But my goodness, that's a lot of food.
I was thinking, my gosh. Anyway, he was then led to the death chamber just before midnight. When asked if he had any last words, this is what he said. What is about to transpire in a few moments is wrong. However, we as human beings do make mistakes and errors. This execution is one of those wrongs. Yet, doesn't mean our whole system of justice is wrong. Therefore, I would forgive all who have taken part in any way in my death. Also, to anyone I have offended in any way during my 39 years, I pray and ask your forgiveness, just as I forgive anyone who has offended me in any way. And I pray and ask God's forgiveness for all of us, respectively, as human beings. To my loved ones, I extend my undying love. To those close to me, know in your hearts, I love you, one and all. God bless you all, and may God's best blessings be yours. During my time here, I have been treated well by all personnel. Not one stinking word about his son.
Mm-mm.
Not one word.
And do you know, when you were reading that, I was hearing Aunt Earl's.
Yes.
Those were some of her last words. And if our listeners don't know.
Yeah.
If our listeners don't know who we're talking about, it was our third episode that you did about Aunt Earl. If you haven't heard it, I might have just given a spoiler, but yeah. That's what that reminds me of.
Yeah. Me too. Ugh. Just after midnight, he was given the concoction that would end his life. And outside, a group was gathered, and the moment that they announced Ronald Clark O'Brien was dead, thousands of people gathered in the streets, yelled in unison, "Trick or treat!"
Oh. I'm sorry, that is a fitting end to that.
Yes. O'Brien died without ever admitting to a living soul that he killed his son. When asked about his feelings, Jim Bates said, "As much as I'd like to say I'm sorry for him, I'm not.
Mm-mm.
The death penalty is bad, but it's not as bad as that little boy's death. People didn't see a picture of Tim's coffin and didn't think about him with foam coming out of his mouth dying on that bathroom floor when they were protesting O'Brien's execution."
Mm.
And he said it was only by the grace of God and sheer luck that it was only Timothy who died that night.
Mm-hmm.
He said they got the right guy and he deserved to die because he gave Tim the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, "Halloween, as we once knew it, is ruined. And Jim Bates and his family never trick-or-treated again."
Oh.
Dainene, Timothy O'Brien's mother, never cashed in the $31,000 life insurance check she'd received at his death. Even though she had serious financial problems as a result of Ronald O'Brien, she said that it was blood money and she'd get by without it.
And you can't blame her for that. That would be really hard.
Yeah.
Ugh. Poor woman. Well, I've never heard that one before. And it was, it's just chilling. It's just to believe anybody can do that.
Yeah.
And then go to their grave proclaiming their innocence.
He sang at his kid, at his funeral.
I know. And see, again, sociopath.
Yes.
I just don't think anybody could
do that.
That's
on another level. I mean, I think sometimes people do terrible things, but they do actually feel bad about it. It eats them up.
Mm-hmm.
There is a conscience there.
Yes. And like you said, this was like another level.
I read an article about a guy who was really young, and he took pictures at his execution. And he said he doesn't know if he maybe actually convinced himself that he was innocent. Looking at him was looking in the eyes of pure evil.
Those sure were some hard times.
They sure were.
I remember one Halloween when our kids were little and our bank account was littler, my wife tried to make our youngest son a hobo costume. Bless his little heart. He looked more like an Oompa Loompa that got fired for being on meth. If you want a guarantee to never have to explain to your friends why you can no longer sing riddles and dance while simultaneously making candy, download every episode and tell everybody you know and a few people you don't to check out Hard Times and True Crimes. Till next time, goodbye.